This week on The Best of Flashpoints, author Norman Finkelstein talks about his new book, This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. British Iraqi hip-hop artist Low Key discusses the merging of music, activism, and the information war when it comes to Western policies in the Middle East, plus an in-depth conversation with Bedouin Palestinian lawyer Rawia Abu Rabia, who talks about the untold stories of ongoing ethnic cleansing and legalized discrimination in Israel against its indigenous citizens. And Jesse Strauss speaks with two UC Berkeley students on hunger strike to protest Arizona's racist anti-immigrant legislation. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Nearly a year and a half after Israel's U.S.-made warplanes and helicopter gunships hovered over the hermetically sealed Gaza Strip, killing 1,400 Palestinians and wounding 5,000 in the three-week assault, the humanitarian situation for Gaza's 1.5 million people remains at the brink of despair. Israel's U.S.-supported blockade continues to restrict essential aid, goods, and materials, while lethal attacks by land, air, and sea continue. Yet sustained international outrage and condemnation of the 2008-2009 Gaza invasion has produced a tipping point that, our next guest argues, could mobilize the world's public in support of true, lasting peace and justice in Palestine. Joining us to talk about his new book, This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion, is Norman Finkelstein. Finkelstein is also the author of The Holocaust Industry, Beyond Chutzpah, An Image and Reality of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Norman Finkelstein, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin by having you talk about what you witnessed when you returned to the Gaza Strip in June of 2009, about a year ago, which was about 6 months after the attacks on Gaza and the Operation Cast Lead assault. This is after you were prevented by the Israeli government from entering Israel for 10 years in a blatant attack on you for the work that you've helped to expose in the decades of your writing. Tell us about what you found in Gaza and what struck you the most during your time there.
I guess what struck me the most was how unshocked I was by what I saw. I had just come back a few months, well, not a few months, maybe a year earlier from Lebanon after Israel's July-August 2006 rampage in Lebanon. So I had grown inured already to rubble where there was once buildings, and most of what I saw in Gaza resembled what I saw in Lebanon after the 2006 Israeli assault. The other thing which struck me, as it were in a negative way, was how little the Palestinians I met were given to complaining or publicizing, giving public vent to their anguish or anger. It was people who were desperately trying to resume their lives where they left off before the Israeli assault and just had more important business to take care of than being angry.
Well, and now a year after your visit, things haven't really changed. Tell us about the ongoing attacks by Israel, both on a physical scale as drones and snipers continue to kill Palestinians in Gaza, and on the political level, how Israel levies political attacks against people and organizations who have spoken out against these policies, you know, including the United Nations Special Investigator on the Gaza attacks, Judge Goldstone, and the Goldstone Report.
Well, the basic fact is that Israel has imposed a siege on Gaza, which Amnesty International called a flagrant violation of international law, which the report by the mission headed by Richard Goldstone called a possible crime against humanity, that siege persists despite its criminality and its egregious illegality. And actually, the siege has gotten worse in many ways because Israel has expanded in one of its terms, it always comes up with these kind of clinical antiseptic terms. So instead of calling it land theft, they call it buffer zone. And the buffer zone they've created in Gaza now absorbs fully 30% of the agricultural land in Gaza. They keep expanding it, dropping leaflets saying you can't farm here, using, as always, the pretext of security. But in my opinion, these are just pretexts. They keep expanding their so-called buffer zone and keep limiting more and more the territorial waters in which the Palestinian fishermen can go in order to make the siege as unlivable as possible, in the hopes that, as former President Ronald Reagan famously put it in the case of the Nicaraguan Sandinista regime, to keep tightening the screws until, again using Reagan's terms, but now applying them to Gaza, Israel keeps tightening the siege until the Palestinians finally cry uncle and get rid of Hamas. Richard Goldstone's report has proven impossible to discredit on the facts, and so now there's commenced a very ugly personal assault on Goldstone. It began with the allegations that he was, well, they tried to call him, or they called the report anti-Semitic, but didn't quite call him an anti-Semite, which in his case was so over the top that they didn't even try it. But then the attacks became even more personal. In the last month, the South African Zionist Federation orchestrated a campaign to prevent Goldstone from attending the bar mitzvah of his grandson. And now there's a new campaign which began actually today, launched by one of Israel's main newspapers, to go through or expose Goldstone's record during the apartheid regime and to show that he was responsible as a judge sitting on, I guess at that time, I'm not sure, I think he was sitting on the Constitutional Court, their highest court. He was responsible for sentencing or affirming the sentence of 28 South African blacks to death. And so now they're trying to turn him into a hanging judge and hypocrite in order to discredit him. And you could be sure that Israel's Department of Dirty Tricks is going through all of his personal history. And hopefully he's kept a pretty clean personal record, because they will air all the dirty laundry in a desperate attempt to kill the messenger, because they've found it impossible to discredit the message.
That's the voice of Norman Finkelstein. We're talking about Gaza and his new book, This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. And yeah, actually, Ynet, the Israeli newspaper that you're referencing about Goldstone, Israel is quoting him saying that he's a man of double standards.
Uh-huh.
What's your reaction to this notion of Israel calling Goldstone a man of double standards when they have, in fact, built policies on double standards against Palestinians?
Well, I think there are two aspects to the question, leaving aside the gross hypocrisy. On one hand, whatever standards he is, a man of double standards, triple standards, or quadruple standards, or quintuple standards, it's irrelevant to the content of the report. And they've not been able successfully, despite many attempts, they've not been able successfully to discredit its content, which from a legal and moral as well as political point of view is the only relevant consideration. It's as if, let's say, for argument's sake, he even were a self-hating Jew, an anti-Semite, or a Holocaust denier. Let's say all three are true. It still wouldn't change whether or not the report is accurate any more than if he were a self-loving Jew and a Holocaust affirmer. That would make a lie the truth. One's personal predispositions have no bearing whatsoever on the content of your work. So that to me is irrelevant. It makes it's a as they call it, a red herring. But the other interesting point, of course, is in some respect, Richard Goldstone's persona is really what it's all about, because there were many reports condemning Israel's attack on Gaza from credible sources like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and a raft of Israeli and Palestinian human rights reports came out. What made Goldstone's report so devastating in its impact was precisely the fact that he is a liberal Jewish Zionist, and that has two significances. Number one, because he was a liberal Jewish Zionist, it proved impossible for Israel to use its usual weapons to discredit the report. They couldn't very well call him an anti-Semite, a self-hating Jew, or a Holocaust denier, given his well-known personal commitment to Israel and to Zionism. And secondly, the reason the report is so significant in terms of Goldstone's person is that it's emblematic of the crisis of liberal Zionism. Namely, it's no longer possible for those Jews who call themselves liberal, and Jews, after all, overwhelmingly call themselves liberal. About 80% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama. It's impossible for Jews who call themselves liberal any longer to defend Israeli conduct. Israeli conduct has become indefensible. So in that respect as well, it is very significant who Goldstone is personally, but that's a political significance. In terms of an intellectual or a truth value significance, Goldstone's person is totally irrelevant. You might say there's also a third significance, which is your listeners will never remember because they're way too old, but in 1963, the United States orchestrated a coup in Vietnam in which the then President Diem was killed. It was orchestrated by the Kennedy administration. And then a few months later, JFK was assassinated. And Diem's sister-in-law was a woman named Madame Nu. And, of course, she knew that it was Kennedy that killed her brother-in-law. And she wrote this stinging message to Jacqueline Kennedy at that time, saying, "Now you know how it feels." And, you know, for some of us, watching what's being done to Goldstone, these personal attacks to just so vicious and so ugly, down to the point of trying to wreck his grandson's bar mitzvah, which is just so ugly, so over the top in its ugliness. Part of me says, well, now they see how it feels, because that's, if I can speak for a moment personally, that's how what I went through as I watched these allegations being hurled against me. Things like my late mother was a Nazi collaborator. And even just 2 weeks ago in the main national Jewish newspaper, The Forward, they wrote this very ugly review of a documentary that was done on my life. And it ends on the note of Finkelstein hates himself and he hates his parents. You know, I don't care what you say about me, but you know, to say that I hate my parents. So, you know, now liberal Jews who in good conscience have reached a point that they can't defend Israel any longer, they're now getting to know how it feels.
Norman Finkelstein, you're one of the most meticulous researchers of Israeli policies and the attempts to justify them. And over the years, of course, you've exposed in detail the way in which concocted allegations of anti-Semitism or self-hatred, all of this, is used to defend Israeli policies against international condemnation. And this still seems to be the first thing shouted at criticism, that, you know, this government or this person is anti-Semitic or self-hating. You know, know, and as you said, it can't justify Israeli policies. Tell us about, you know, where you think this argument is going. I mean, it still has legs. People still react to it.
No, I don't think so. I think that's over. I think that's probably one of the most significant repercussions of the Goldstone, maybe we should call it the Goldstone moment, is that the allegations of anti-Semite and so on, they were already losing their efficaciousness when they were being hurled at people like Jimmy Carter. But now with Goldstone trying to use those allegations against him, it's over. Nobody's going to take it seriously anymore. You know, there are a few barkers, yelpers, like Jeffrey Goldberg, who are trying to use that weapon against people like John Mearsheimer. But people like Mearsheimer have managed to keep their dignity, not get into a street brawl with these thugs. And after Goldstone, I think Israel's going to have a very big problem for a simple reason. Goldstone has changed the rules. Israel now is going to be judged by the facts and not by the messenger, or it will be judged by the message now and not by the messenger. The tactic Israel has honed over the last 30 years of using the Holocaust and allegations of anti-Semitism to discredit its critics, I think that tactic is over.
Gaza, Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse at the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we're automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the sound of Low Key. The song is called Long Live Palestine, and it was at the top of the iTunes hit list after it was released following the massacres in Gaza by Israeli occupation forces last year. Low Key is an Iraqi-British hip-hop artist and activist. He's been outspoken about the longtime injustices in Palestine and Iraq and the region, and has collaborated with well-known artists including Dams, Shadia Mansour, and The Narcissist, as well as many others. Low Key, it's great to have you with us today on Flashpoints.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off by having you talk about your work a little bit and how you've been able to blend music with activism, especially in the context of opening people's eyes to the reality on the ground in occupied Palestine. You've actually performed inside the West Bank in Gaza while discovering for yourself with your own eyes what is taking place under apartheid and military occupation there. For you, why is it important to blend music and activism, and what stands out for you the most about what you saw in Palestine?
Okay, well, just a slight correction. I didn't get to perform in Gaza, but I did travel there, but I got to perform quite a lot in the West Bank. But the first part of the question, I think I'd like to think that regardless of the music I make, I would be politically active. But I do think ultimately that even just the music we make is, in regard to the artists that you named and also Immortal Technique and other artists I've worked with, is that it is a form of political activism, because I think people need a soundtrack for their struggle and they need a soundtrack for their involvement in what they do. And I think the music is often the first step for people. So somebody might listen to one of my songs and then actually want to go deeper into the issue than a song allows and read a Norman Finkelstein book. So it's like I hope the music can sort of be a bridge and a pathway to people's, you know, furthering their understanding of certain situations. As far as what stood out for me the most in Palestine, there were different things. I mean, in the West Bank, what stood out for me the most is how the hospitality of the people under occupation and how different the cultures were from the UK, for example. So at one point, I was in Jenin, and I said to this guy I saw, I said, "Oh, I like your shoes." And he said, "You can have them." I wanted to take off his shoes. And I think that's such a different way of acting than British culture. Of course, this is something, you know, this is something Arabs do. But, you know, it was incredible. This guy is a refugee, and he's offering me his shoes. And I just saw people there that I just wish I could give my passport to and let them, you know, let them have some type of freedom of movement, because that's what they don't have. And at one point, we were with a guy we met in Ramallah. We got a permit to take him to Haifa the last night we were there, and he'd never seen the sea before, because being from Ramallah, you need a permit, and if you don't have a permit, then they fine you 20,000 shekels and make you clean the cars of the Israeli police if you're from Ramallah. And so we got him the permit, and we saw the sea for the first time with him. And so that was really a special moment, I think. And actually, at that point when we were in Haifa, we were right next to this derelict building. And we went up inside the derelict building to the top of it. And on the wall, was sprayed on the wall, a swastika. And it said next to the swastika, "Hail Israel." And so that really stayed with me. Just the image of that swastika and what it meant was really incredible to me.
That's the voice of Loki. And Loki, you're traveling the country with Norman Finkelstein, who said earlier on this program that he's hoping to bring more people, especially the younger generation, into the fold of Palestine activism and social justice issues related to what's happening in the Middle East. And I think that when we look at what's happening on North American campuses in particular, in the context of the expanding boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, it's gaining momentum, and it brings young people from all spectrums together. Talk about the response that you're seeing from young people to the ongoing atrocities in Palestine, especially since the Gaza massacres last year, and where you think this movement is headed.
Well, I think what they referred to as Operation Carcer, I think that really mobilized, galvanized, it really got people to, got people active, especially in the campuses in the UK. I've witnessed a lot of activity here as well, but, you know, in the UK, I was surprised at how much it, you know, put the fire in people's bellies. I think ultimately the students are where the change will come from when change does come. And the most important thing I personally think is public perception, because I think there's such a machine at work to make people's perception of this situation very warped and very very inaccurate. And I think that the good thing about boycotting is it causes people who don't know about the situation to ask questions, to think, hold on, why are they boycotting Israel? Because to the average person on the street who has relations with Israel completely normalized and who is given no context of the situation and is given no context of the reality, they really don't know what's going on. They think it's simply a question of Israel versus Palestine, like two countries at war. This is not the situation we are dealing with. So I think it's important to change that perception, and I think that's where it will start in the universities, definitely.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. On a regular basis, Israeli bulldozers and squads of police invade Palestinian Bedouin villages, carrying out widespread home demolitions and leaving entire communities reduced to rubble. We all know that this happens inside the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, but today we're going to talk about these policies that are being carried out within the state of Israel itself. Over 70,000 indigenous Bedouins live in the Negev Desert region in dozens of so-called unrecognized villages, communities that the state has refused to acknowledge despite the fact that most of them have existed before the state of Israel was established. Moreover, Israeli politicians often refer to the areas as, quote, empty, in order to create support for building new Jewish settlements, effectively removing the indigenous populations, continuing an ethnic cleansing project that is now over 62 years old. Joining us to talk about the current situation for the indigenous Palestinian communities inside the state of Israel is Rawia Abu Rabia. She is a social activist and human rights lawyer representing her community and advocating for their human and civil rights as the state continues to discriminate and uproot people across the country. She lives in Beersheba in Israel. Rawia, it's so good to have you with us today on Flashpoints.
Thanks for inviting me.
Let's start off by having you explain the current crisis facing the indigenous populations living inside the state of Israel, what we call historic Palestine as well. Explain what these so-called unrecognized villages are and tell us about the level of institutionalized racism and discrimination and what's going on in terms of home demolitions right now.
Okay, so first we're talking about the indigenous Bedouin community, which is part of the Palestinian people, and they are citizens of Israel, although they are not treated as an equal citizen. Half of the Bedouins that exist, I mean, the Bedouins as an indigenous community exist before the establishment of the state for so many centuries, and they were using agriculture and other forms to live. And basically, they were internally displaced by the State of Israel starting from the Nakba from 48, where they were transferred into an area, a geographical area called the Siyaj area, which is, it means fence. They were restricted from moving from one place to another until 66 as part of the military regime that the Palestinian citizens of Israel were subjected to. Then the state decided to so-called urbanize the Bedouin and established 7 governmental townships that are among the poorest towns in Israel, and forcibly moved the Bedouin into this Thai geographical area, which is known for its low agricultural fertility. And basically, the purpose was to have as many Bedouins as possible in a minimum land. So their ancestral lands were given to the new Jewish cities and other forms of urban and non-urban way of life, while they were restricted from going back to their historical villages. And then the state started to have different laws that their purpose was to take over the Bedouins' land. For instance, in 65, the construction and building law, which designed the master plan for Israeli cities and villages, didn't take into consideration the Bedouin villages. And by doing that, the state used the law and the legal mechanism to displace the Bedouins and make them illegal. That's why today we have about 80,000 Bedouins, Palestinian citizens of Israel, that live in about 35 villages that the state of Israel refused to recognize. And what I mean by the lack of recognition, it means that they don't appear on official maps. They are denied from basic services, running water, electricity, and other basic services such as garbage disposal. They are not allowed to build permanent houses, and those who do that, they risk heavy fines and home demolition. In 2009, 254 houses were demolished in these villages. The state of Israel and state officials ignore their existence. They are invisible citizens in the eyes of the law. And the other half, Bedouins, live in the 7 townships that I mentioned that are among the poorest and developed towns in Israel. And the percentage of dropout from schools in these villages is almost 60%. The rate of unemployment is extremely high. The level of school is very poor. And as a result, the Bedouins are not entitled and are not practiced the same rights as the Jewish citizens. And the saddest thing in this that it institutionalized racism and discrimination that is written in the law, especially the laws related to land issue were designed to criminalize the Bedouins, basically, and make them illegal.
What do the laws say? What is written in these laws?
First of all, the laws that related to lands are discriminatory. I will give you a very simple example. While since the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 until today, hundreds of Jewish cities and other forms of living, such as agriculture, settlements, etc., were established. While almost very few Arab, besides the seven townships that I mentioned, the Bedouin townships, no Arab village or city were established. Another example is the issue that this Siyaj area in the Negev that the Bedouins were concentrate in, it's the only place basically that Bedouins can live. If Bedouin want to live in other place, he will face all kind of discriminatory mechanisms such as criteria to be accepted and live to in certain villages in Israel. I mentioned this construction and building law from 65, so the master plan for Israel, for the cities in Israel that didn't include any of the Bedouin villages. So basically, by the law, the Bedouins are illegal. Today, in many Arab villages in Israel that they want to, you know, build houses or expand their villages, they don't get permits from the planning authorities to do so. And by doing that, basically, they are deprived from the basic right of housing, and the state doesn't provide any alternative. And even when the homes have been demolished in the unrecognized Bedouin villages, no compensation or alternative housing is provided by the state, although in according to international law, such an alternative should be provided. There are also, for instance, other laws such as the citizenship law that according to this law, if you are a Palestinian Israeli citizen and want to marry an Arab Palestinian person from, let's say, occupied territories or one of the Arab countries, your spouse will not get citizenship. He will be deprived, while if you are Jewish, an Israeli Jewish, and you will marry, let's say, someone, you know, foreigner from one of the countries abroad, they will get into the process of citizenship. There is another law, the law of return, which is a law that says that Jewish can, anyone who is, has a mother which is Jewish could come to Israel and get an Israeli citizenship, while Palestinians that were expelled in 1948, as we all know, the refugees cannot return and get any rights, and their property and lands are declared as absent property, where they're, the people that own these lands are still alive, so it's not they're not absent.
That's the voice of Rawia Abu Rabia. She's a social activist and human rights lawyer speaking to us from Be'er Sab'a. And Rawia, let's talk a little bit more about these home demolitions. Last month, the Bedouin village of Twel Abu Jarwal in the Naqab, in the Negev, was demolished for the 40th time. That's 40 times in the last few years alone. Tell us about these kinds of actions by the Israeli government and what happens during these home demolitions and what happens to the people.
First of all, this demolition, you know, we're talking about home demolition, but actually we're talking about very poor shakes and tents that have been demolished. I mean, we are talking about very poor community, very young community. About 70% of the Bedouin community is below the age of 18. So we're talking about a young community. And these bulldozers come into these poor places, these shakes and tents, and demolish them. And the purpose is to pressure the Bedouin to leave their land so the state can take control over their lands. There are other mechanisms that used as well to take over land, such as the Jewish National Fund. They recently planted trees on the village and lands of the Larraqib tribe. And this is another form and the mechanism to take over more land and more land and pressure people to leave their lands, because people, the Bedouin community know, and based on the Palestinian experience, the bitter experience of the Palestinian people, that the only way, you know, that they will have a chance to have their land is physically stay on their land, sumud, you know. And this is this very aggressive way to try and push people away from their land without any consideration of international law, of the Declaration on Indigenous People issue, or other way. And this is actually push people to be hostile and to lose any trust in the Israeli authorities, if we're talking about legal authorities or other authorities. And people become bitter when they see the discrimination alive, when they see it in front of them, and they see the way that the bulldozers come and destroy their homes without providing any alternative, any compensation, nothing.
That's the voice again of Rawia Abu Rabia. And Rawia, walk us through one of these Bedouin villages. Talk about the kinds of conditions that Bedouins are living in right now, you know, as they face home demolitions. What kind of services are they prohibited from accessing as villagers in these communities?
First of all, when their homes been demolished, they, you know, as I mentioned, left without any alternative, and sometimes they are, you know, outside without any possibility to have a house. You know, it's the basic thing, no alternative. But besides of that, most of the unrecognized Bedouin villages lack also health services and other services as well. And if they want to access services in the nearest Jewish city or elsewhere, they have to first walk for miles to get to the main road and then to find transportation, since they don't have public transportation within these villages because, as I mentioned, they are unrecognized by the state of Israel. So they have to walk for miles in order to get to the nearest bus station or other way of transportation to get the services. And by the way, the few services, few clinics that we have in some of the villages are a result of petitions to the Supreme Court. So, and most of the villages, all of the villages are not connected to electricity at all, which also affects them. So if a bulldozer come and destroy houses during the winter time, you can imagine that they will be left, you know, we're talking about the desert area, which is very cold during nights, and then they don't have any way to find the heating or other ways of, you know, just handle themselves until they will find other solutions.
Rawia, we've been following the story of the Palestinian unrecognized village of Dahmash outside of Lid near the Ben-Gurion airport, 20 minutes away from Tel Aviv. And the people there are in and out of the high court, hoping to get another injunction to prevent the bulldozers from demolishing 13 homes there. Can you talk about what's happening to communities like this, which are inside more urban areas around the state, not in the desert, Palestinians who are forced into displacement as the Jewish communities grow and expand?
I mean, I think that's why the issue of the Bedouins are not disconnected from the issue of other Palestinian community live inside Israel. That's the part of the Palestinian issue, the part of the daily issues that we are facing as Palestinian Israeli citizens that are treated as second-class citizens and even worse. And the land is the main resource that been denied from a Palestinian, and we see in for instance in Jaffa, which is there Jewish and Arabs, we see how Jaffa is developed. Thing for Jewish citizens and Arab citizens are kicked out from their spaces. And that's the issue. I mean, it's the issue of the Naqab with the Bedouins. It's issue of maybe we could call it mixed towns of Jaffa or Lib. And it's also in the Galilee in Masjid Al-Krum where there is a home in demolition orders and lots of house over there as well. So I think it's like if we can link between, it's the same cause. That's why the feeling of people, of citizens, of Palestinian citizens of Israel, that we were displaced in 48 and in 67, and the process of the internal displacement is happening all the time, especially now with the right wing government that is following these racist policies and pushing Palestinians, Israeli citizens, more and more outside of their villages and outside, try to delegitimize their existence as people. So I think that's what links the whole cause, and it's the cause of being Palestinian, and it's worse when you're Palestinian, Israeli citizens, and treated in an unequal way.
Raweh, you met the special rapporteur for Indigenous people at the United Nations in New York about a week or two ago. Tell us what went on in the meeting and what the UN is doing to address the critical needs for the Palestinian and Bedouin communities inside Israel.
I had a meeting with the special rapporteur, Professor James Anaya, and I explained to him the situation of the Bedouins in the Negev and the internal displacement that they are going through, the home demolitions, the decision of the government to triple the demolition orders for Bedouin villages. And he's very much concerned with the situation of the Palestinian Bedouins in the Naqab. And he mentioned that he will follow up with the situation. I urged him to come and visit these villages and see, because I could sit there and describe him, but I think the best thing is if he will come and see the demolitions that are taking place, the actions that are taking place in one purpose to push the people away from their lands and houses. So I hope that he will accept the invitation and will eventually come and visit. But in the meantime, he said that he will follow up the issues that I raised with the Israeli government.
That's the voice of Raweh Abu Rabia. We're talking about the current situation for Indigenous people living as citizens of the State of Israel. Raweh, tell us about your work as a lawyer representing these communities. What is it like voicing their concerns to the state as Israel pretty much goes ahead and continues to depopulate, displace, and discriminate on a daily basis?
I think it's a lawyer for human rights working at the Association for Civil Rights. I'm facing challenges all the time because on one hand, I am facing discrimination as a Bedouin citizen, a citizen of Israel. I just faced discrimination when I came back from the UN by El Al Airlines. I faced a huge humiliation just because I'm an Arab. But on the other hand, the only tool, effective tool that I can use to advocate for my people is the legal tool and the other tools as well. So it's a challenge all the time because you have to keep on, you have to be optimistic that although there are, I mean, my biggest dilemma is how can I advocate for equality in a discriminatory reality. And that's the biggest challenge for me because sometimes the Supreme Court could give good decisions, but sometimes because of some discriminatory laws, it could provide the opposite decision that is not on the best for my people. But I think that as a Palestinian Israeli citizen, I must use the legal tool to advocate for my people, and I believe in the international mechanisms as well, because I think that we have to use the international mechanisms to put pressure on Israel to change its policies toward the Bedouins. Now, people sometimes are very frustrated with the situation, and even when they see that the legal system is not equal and is not, you know, legal system, people think that it's supposed to provide the answers for things, but usually not all in all cases that's the situation. But that's the situation, and we have to promote equality in an unequal reality. I mean, that we don't have other options, and we have to continue in this way.
Rawia, Israeli politicians regularly describe the state as a moral democracy for all of its citizens, but it's clear that it's a democracy only for a certain ethnicity, a certain religion. What can you say about this unequal so-called democracy and what it looks like in historic Palestine and Israel today? What's your response to how Israeli leaders represent these policies?
I think that member of Knesset Ahmed Tibi said that once that Israel is democratic for Jews and Jewish for Arabs. And I think that that describes the situation, that it's democratic for the Jewish citizens, but it's Jewish for the Arab citizens. And I think it's, and others like Professor Oren Yiftachel said that it's actually ethnocracy, it's not democracy. So we could argue whether it could be a democratic and Jewish state or not. You know, we don't have, Israel doesn't have a constitution. It doesn't have separation between religion and the state. It has some problematic issues related to violation of women's rights because of this lack of separation between religious laws and the state. And so it is very problematic democracy. And we are witnessing lately also harassment of human rights activists and organizations that are the last resort for the so-called democracy, that they are the only voice that represent, talk about these human rights violations that are taking place in the so-called democratic state.
In Berkeley, I'm Jesse Strauss. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're continuing now with our coverage of UC Berkeley's hunger strike, which for 10 full days pushed against budget cuts, demanded a sanctuary campus for students, and a public denunciation of Arizona's new law, SB 1070, which essentially legalizes racial profiling. After 10 days without food, hunger strikers at UC Berkeley began eating yesterday. Today we're joined by Ricardo Gomez, a student on the negotiating team, as well as Alejandro Lara Briceño, a striker who we spoke with last week. He is the only striker who has continued without food. Before we speak with them, let's hear a small piece of the rally by strikers from this past Tuesday, May 11th.
Number of hours on hunger strike, 195.
Number of people on hunger strike since last Monday, 18. Number of dry strikers going on with no food and no water, 9.
Number of solidarity hunger strikers, 25.
Number of official faculty supporters, 73.
Total number of police officers, too many to count.
Number of pounds I've lost as a striker, 15.
Number of chancellors willing to meet with hunger strikers, 0.
Number of days that I'm willing to be on this hunger strike, there is no limit because I will not stop until the chancellor meets with us.
The last voice you heard was that of Alejandro Lara Briceño. We are lucky to have him on the phone today, along with Ricardo Gomez, who was on the negotiating team with UC Berkeley's chancellor yesterday. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ricardo, could we start with the events of yesterday and the meeting you were involved in with the chancellor? What happened, and do you feel positive about the outcomes?
Yesterday, we had a rally at 3:30, as we had been having for the last few days, and we were able to schedule a meeting with the chancellor to talk about our demands, which was sort of a breakthrough because prior to that, they were not really willing to give us a meeting, and they really weren't willing to talk about the demands all that much. Before then, we were in discussion or dialogue mode, but not really making movement on the demands too much. But we were able to come to a consensus, and we were able to get the university to commit to a number of different things, including a number of task forces to move forward with a number of the demands, as well as a commitment for $50,000 for the next 5 years for the Latino Center for Policy Research, which was not receiving any funding this year because of budget cuts. And so, you know, we weren't able to get everything that we wanted, but I think that it was positive in that we now can hold the university accountable through these task forces to actually make some change for students of color. The chancellor made a statement against SB 1070 as well, and that was a few days ago. He also committed to come out against the ethnic studies bill in the near future as soon as he finds the proper avenue to do so. So we got a lot of things that we wouldn't have gotten without the power of the hunger strike behind us. So overall, I would say it was a really positive thing, and it's really got a lot of students on our campus to think about the way that the racism in Arizona is connected to the racism here at home, and how we need to organize both locally and nationally to end racism.
So another one of the demands that you had brought to the table there was to give institutional support to the students who had been arrested during the budget cut protests earlier this year. Was there any kind of response to that? What did the chancellor say?
Well, the chancellor had recused himself from talking about student conduct because it was his house that was under attack at one point. So we were able to come to an agreement where they agreed to proposed community service as a possible alternative for the people who are involved in protests, specifically the Wheeler Hall occupation. The idea behind the student code of conduct here at Berkeley and the student code of conduct process is that it's an educational process rather than a punitive process. And so we argued that it didn't make sense to propose suspension. They were proposing a 7-month suspension for students who were involved. That was punitive. It wasn't really... You don't really learn all that much from, you know, getting suspended for 7 months. And so they're willing to propose that as an alternative, but it's not a guarantee for those students who are involved in those protests. And so, you know, we got something, but we didn't necessarily get everything that we wanted.
And maybe now we can move to Alejandro. Alejandro, you've continued your strike beyond all of your peers. Can you tell us why and how long you plan to continue your strike? Sure. And what motivates you?
The reason why I continue with the hunger strike is because I'm deeply committed to nonviolence. And the act of a hunger strike isn't ever done to change the mind of an individual. This was never about just Chancellor Bergino. And to be clear, this is about our community. This is about my love for my community and for my family. And in terms of what motivates me, I have family that lives in Maricopa County. That's the county that Sheriff Joseph Arpaio oversees and which he is engaged in the oppression of. And so they're the ones that motivate me. It was my family that gave me permission and the blessings to begin this hunger strike as a way to communicate to our community that we must all stand together, and at the sacrifice of an individual, the sacrifice of a few individuals at the UC Berkeley campus, is just a way to bring greater attention to the sufferings of the oppression of our communities in Arizona, and so that is why we'll continue. On the 20th of this month, I will be flying out to Mexico, but on the way there, I have a four-hour layover in the city of Phoenix, and that is a city where my sister and my four nephews live. I hope to be able to meet with them during that time, at which point, with their blessing, I will end my hunger strike once I board the plane, and in solidarity with the people of Arizona, with the oppressed communities in Arizona, I will not eat until the airplane breaks Arizonian airspace and enters into Mexico.
So you said you'll be entering Mexico on the 20th of May, which is another whole week away. How long have you been going without food? How have you been feeling? And it's wonderfully impressive that you feel like you'll be able to go for another 7 days.
Well, I've been on the hunger strike since the 3rd of May, which I believe that makes today the 11th day. It will be a total of 18 days, and it is the concern. I've received many, many emails from professors, from my fellow students, from community members. I've spoken with my family, and everyone is concerned, but I am getting daily medical attention to make sure that I'm okay. But it is that love and concern from them, as well as the knowledge of the suffering and the oppression that my communities are experiencing in Arizona, that gives me the strength of spirit to continue in the hunger strike. And I hope to be able to meet with some organizers during that four-hour layover, because there has been talk about a hunger strike beginning with students and or community members in the state of Arizona.
So we only have about half a minute left, but maybe we could go back to Ricardo quickly. How do you feel the negotiations went, and what are next steps? What's the climate like at UC Berkeley among these people who are striking, who didn't eat for over a week?
I mean, I think that that there's still tremendous energy among the people who did the hunger strike, who are involved in organizing, and I don't foresee this movement dying out or becoming weaker, but growing stronger and bigger. And it's not about the negotiations. Again, it's not about whether or not we achieve our demands, but it's about the community that we built and the community that we're going to continue to build as organizers to make social change, both on our campus and nationally.
Well, we're out of time, but those are the voices of Ricardo Gomez and Alejandro Lara Briceño from UC Berkeley. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. Alejandro, best of luck with the rest of your protest.
Thank you.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.